This morning, we did not make it all the way through verse 41. Probably you all picked up on that. I didn't read through the passage, and we didn't work through it systematically like I normally do. I just highlighted some three groups out of the text, and tonight we're going to take a closer look at those groups. There was the religious authorities, if you remember. We talked about the chief priests, the elders, the scribes, the whole council. They were the ones that bound Jesus and carried him over to Pilate. Then we talked about Pilate and his involvement just in brevity this morning, and Herod, that of Herod's, because of course when Pilate heard that Jesus was Galilean, he sent Jesus up to Herod because Herod was the client king over the region of Galilee at the time, and so Pilate was looking for an easy out, and as it turned out, Herod said, "I don't want any part of this." Well, Jesus wasn't performing for him, so he sent him back to Pilate. So tonight we're going to look a little bit more in depth at what's going on in the Roman world and as it is pertinent to this passage with Pontius Pilate. And then the last group that we looked at were the soldiers. I don't have a lot of information on them tonight, but I did take a little bit of time to research the scourging. Probably all of you are familiar with the beating of Jesus preceding the crucifixion. You've probably heard multiple sermons on it. You've studied maybe on it yourself. And so there may be no news tonight on that matter. But still, it's a sobering thought to think of what our Savior went through even preceding the cross. When you think of the horrors of just the cross, that's unbelievable, unfathomable almost. But when you think about all that he went through leading up to Calvary's tree, it's even more sobering. And so we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. So to start off, we're talking about the religious authorities there in verse 1. And straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate. If you're like me, you look at that verse and you think, okay, that seems pretty straightforward. But who were the chief priests? So as I started looking into this, the chief priests are kind of an interesting bunch. I never know how big the font needs to be here. So if you can see this, great. And if not, sorry. I'll try to get it bigger next time. And please let me know if you can't see it and you're like, come on, Pastor. You know, it's not like we're saving on ink here. The chief priests, first of all, there was a group that were probably included in this phrase, chief priests, those that were kind of head of temple operations. First of all, you would have had the anointed high priest. He would have been a descendant of the priestly lineage and was ordained to that spot. And just like you would think of somebody who is anointed to a position, like remember in the Old Testament, David, who was anointed to be king, and before him, Saul, they were identified, and while we wouldn't say that there was something significant about the oil being poured over them as far as the oil is concerned, certainly that was God's means of identifying this person. And if you carry that thought on through, then Messiah, the word Messiah, and then Christ, as it's translated, means the anointed one, the chosen one, the one that God has picked out as the blessing, the one that God has singled out to take care of the needs of mankind. He is the Messiah, the anointed one. Well, the anointed high priest would have been part of this group of chief priests, and that seems logical to me, right? But then you would have also had possibly the invested high priest. Now, I didn't follow through to see if at that time there actually was an invested high priest, but this would have been the high priest that was appointed by the political leader, and at that time, or maybe preceding this, would have been maybe Herod, who says, you know what? I don't really like the anointed high priest. I want to have my own. And would have applied then political pressure on temple operations. And so he would have appointed a high priest. So you might have had an anointed high priest, an invested high priest. Then you would have had the captain of the priests. He was in charge of temple operations and over the temple police. Now here's an interesting thought. Maybe you've never thought about the temple needing police before. But there is a lot going on at the temple at this time, right? And it would not have been uncommon, possibly, to have people coming in off the street knowing that, hey, if we're just really clever here, cause a distraction over here, we can steal a little bit from the money changers over there. We know there were money changers at the time, right? Because Jesus comes in and absolutely goes bonkers on the money changers there in the temple because of what they had going on, profiting from temple operations. So we know that's the case. Well, they had issues at the temple. You're talking about thousands and thousands of people potentially coming every day to this place. So they had a temple police, they had normal temple operations, and the captain would have been over that. So as a part of the group of chief priests, we've got an anointed chief priest, potentially an invested high priest, a captain, and then you've got the overseers. There were at least seven of them who had gate keys. They were the ones that opened things up and closed things down and were in charge of making sure that the temple facility was secure. They supervised physical arrangements in the temple area. Do you ever think about who patrolled the temple grounds? There was, at that time, the court of the Gentiles outside. What if a Gentile tried to sneak in? Who stopped that, right? Inside of the court of Gentiles was the court of women, Jewish women. They were not allowed to go into the temple proper, but they had a court out there. What if one of the Jewish women just said, you know what, I think I can make it inside this today? Well, who stopped that? Who made sure that those things? So there's a lot going on at the temple. And if you look at in the background here, there's just an artist's rendition of the Herodian temple. But there would have been all kinds of things going on outside. Who's in charge of all of that? It seems like, you know, things around here work pretty well. It's kind of a well-oiled machine. But anytime you do something out of the ordinary, for instance, we just went through the Christmas season and we had the Awana Christmas program here. There was a lot going on behind the scenes. You can ask the commander and his wife about all the work that went into putting that on. That's just a simple program here at East Wenatchee First Baptist Church, Christmas program, right? Excuse me. Well, every day, thousands and thousands of people visiting the temple and all the operations there, the overseers took care of the arrangements in the temple area. Then you would have had the priests' treasurers. They were keeping the coffers. They were keeping the treasury for the temple. There were at least three of them who administered that treasury because you had to have a constant, like buying and selling, and just to make sure and maintain the temple and keep it up. Now, at the time that Jesus is crucified, we're talking between 30-33 AD, the temple is still under construction. As a matter of fact, if memory serves, they finished the temple right about 68 AD, and Titus comes in 70 AD and destroys the thing. So they had a really nice temple for just a couple of years. But during this time, it's under construction. They're building it, and it's really nice. I mean, really nice. But somebody had to keep the treasury, okay? So when it says there in verse 1, the chief priests, and they're gunning for Jesus, right? The chief priests, this gives us some idea of maybe who's involved with all of that. These priests are coming together. They are plotting. They're scheming. In my mind, I see them having meetings together, and they've got to do something about this Jesus. And so they finally get him, and now they can take him to Pontius Pilate. Working with the chief priests, it says here that they took counsel together. They had a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. Who are the elders? I don't know if you've ever wondered that, but I started looking into that. The elders were likely a group of 12 judges who tried cases, usually in the city gates. Now, this wasn't uncommon in ancient times. That's where court would be held. As a matter of fact, the judgment seat where those judges had their courts were called bimas, right? So you may have heard the reference in the New Testament to the bima seat of Christ. It is the place of judgment when Jesus sits down officially as judge, and when he drops the gavel, that's it. There is no appeal, right? The bima in Jerusalem, there would have likely been at least 12 of these different courts. And the judges who sat over or presided over these courts and heard these cases would have been the elders that this is referring to. They were dedicated students of the law. They studied hard to know what does the law say, what are the parameters. So it might have been easy for them to at least read the scriptures and determine for themselves what the scriptures say. But if you were going to be a lawyer at that time, if you were going to be one of these elders, then you also had to add to that the interpretations of the different rabbis. And at the time, there were two prevailing rabbis that had huge followings, really, by this time. And one was more legalistic, and one was more, we would say, gracious. Okay, he was a lot more lenient in his interpretation of the law. So much so that there were ongoing debates between the two camps of these rabbis. And these lawyers would have had to study what the teachings of these rabbis were so that they could then come down on what was an acceptable position on the law. So they were studying all the time. Very, very bright men. Which is no wonder to me then why the high priest or the chief priest would come and consult with the elders. What does the law say? How can we nail Jesus? Because if we can get him in some legal discrepancy, we got him. So you guys are the legal experts. Where's our leverage point here? What can we get him on? As lay, that is not in their vocation religiously, but civilly, as lay scholars, they helped the priests determine transgressions against the Torah. They weren't operating in religious terms as much as they were secular or civil matters. Now, you all understand, I'm sure, that when God gave the law, certainly it was set up as a prominent religious document so that they would know how to operate in worshiping God. That's why he outlines for them how the temple or the tabernacle was to be built and the offerings, the sacrifices, how all of those were to be presented, the choosing of the priests, and all of that is out. Obviously, that's very religious. But hand in hand with that, the law is also given to govern a nation. Israel is leaving Egypt. They're going to move out and claim the promised land, which, of course, they didn't. They were disobedient and so had to wander. But eventually, they did occupy the promised land, and they had to have a law to govern that nation. So the law is really doing double duty for them, and these elders were more concerned with the law as it pertained to the people as a governing document, not as much as a religious document. Now, the priests would have been way more interested in the religious aspect of it, okay? Then it says that not only did they consult with the elders, but also with the scribes. The scribes would have been a closed order of rabbis. Very, very highly respected Jewish teachers. They were believed to have received the spirit of Moses by ordination from a succession of legitimate members of the Guild of Scribes. Doesn't that sound official? Like little Yitzhak wants to grow up and be a rabbi. And so he goes to the leader of the Guild of Rabbis and says, I want to be a rabbi. And maybe his parents are all into this thing. And so he joins the guild and he begins training to be a rabbi. These days, if you were to go to Jerusalem, now I've never been to Jerusalem. I've never seen this firsthand. I just am learning from what I read and watch. But if you were to go to Jerusalem, there are different neighborhoods where you have different sects of Judaism. And the Hasidic Jews, in particular, have men that are training to be rabbis. And you'll have the old rabbi, like in Fiddler on the Roof, you know, the old rabbi that is so highly respected. And he's been studying for decades and decades. And he is kind of the leader of all of the rabbis in training, the younger men that are learning and learning and learning. And every once in a while, as they study, they come up with a question. Now, what do we do with this? So they go to the older, wiser rabbi. Now, rabbi, it says this. And the old, wise rabbi says, yes, and it means thus and such. And they are training so that someday when they are old, they will have a group of student rabbis as well. Well, that's old, old, old. That's how it's worked for many, many, many years. And certainly that was the case back in this time, the scribes. These rabbis were very, very revered. They were, they were highly respected. That's one of the other things that I always appreciated about that movie. There's a lot to learn, by the way, about Jewish culture from Fiddler on the Roof. But all the respect they have for their rabbi, right? He is just like the guy in their culture. They just love him to death. And these scribes would have been very, very respected in Jerusalem. As they came down the market street, people would have been not only talking to them, but they would have been rock stars for the Jews during that time. Okay? So you got the scribes. Then it says that they went to the whole council. Now, my understanding of this is that this is a reference to the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, which was the greater Sanhedrin for the region of Judea and Galilee, really all of that there, what we would consider the Promised Land. It was the greatest Jewish council of that time. There were lesser Sanhedrins, and I'll talk about them in just a minute. But at the greater Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, or Sanhedrin, there were 71 members. Some scholars include the high priest, which then would make 72. I think I've got that right. There might have been 70, and if you include the high priest, there'd be 71. So that he would be breaking the ties, I guess. Along with the previous groups, there were a large number of Jewish aristocrats that held seats in the greater Sanhedrin. So they were well-to-do. Okay, once more back to Fiddler on the Roof. Remember, first of all, how many of you have seen that? Okay, good. We should have movie night at the church and watch it so that as I reference it, people know. But Tevye sings a song in the play, in the movie, If I Were a Rich Man. And there's a line in that song that says one of his greater blessings would be that he would be able to sit in the synagogue and pray, and he would be able to give counsel. Not because he's especially trained for it, but because he's rich. Now I'm a rich man. Now I can have a seat on the Eastern Wall. And I can be giving counsel as a rabbi. Well, did you get your doctorate at rabbi school? No, but I've got bucks, right? That's the idea. And certainly there were some that were sitting on the seats in the Sanhedrin that were just, they were wealthy. And because of that wealth, they had automatic credibility with the people. Now, the way that this was set up is pretty traditional, what you would imagine. It was in like a half circle with different tiers. And if somebody had something to say, they would come down in front of the whole group and they would make their statement or they would make their arguments, and the whole group then would be able to hear them. It wasn't a complete circle, it was just a half circle, okay? And very interesting. So a number of them are gathered together, and you can just, especially based on what we studied this morning with the chief priests coming and inciting the crowd, you can almost sense them coming before the council and convening it and in the morning and saying, we've got to do something about this Jesus. We've talked to the scribes, we've talked to the elders, and we think we've got some charges that we can bring and get him finally done away with. And now they make their presentation before the council. They decided on major legal matters involving either a whole tribe. You know, if you had, there's 12 tribes, right? So if you had one whole tribe that was in real trouble, the Sanhedrin would be convened and they would hear the case then against that tribe. Or if there was a false prophet that was in the land, which makes perfect sense because these are the accusations that the chief priests are bringing against Jesus, right? He's a false prophet. He's claiming to be God, and obviously things are all so. We can now convene the council to hear our case. Or if the high priest himself had something come up, he was in legal trouble, the council would be convened, the Sanhedrin would be called together. Throughout the land, there were lesser Sanhedrins. I mentioned this earlier. They were located in cities of at least 120 Jewish men. There had to be 120 Jewish men in order for them to have a Sanhedrin. They had to have a court of 23. Three judges were needed in cases involving property. Seven judges were needed to see the finances of the court, to see to the finances of the court, and all 23 were convened in capital cases. So if you had a murder take place in Nazareth, for instance, then they would convene the lesser Sanhedrin to hear that case and see to what needed to be done there. Okay, so the Jerusalem Council being called together, this is serious business for the Jews. And the fact that Jesus is being taken and drug over to stand before the council tells us that it's not like they're giving up on this easily. They intend to see it through. So they bring the case before Pontius Pilate. Now, who was Pontius Pilate? He was the prefect in Rome, for Rome at this time in Judea. Now, if you're like me and you think about this for just a second, you're thinking, okay, we already know that Herod is the client king in Galilee, and Pilate is running things for Rome in Judea. Why the difference? Why do we have a client king in the north, and why do we have direct Roman control in Judea? What happened here? What's going on? Well, I'll go through some more of this history in just a little bit, but obviously somewhere along the line, Rome had enough of the client kings and said, okay, we're just going to rule directly in Judea. And those Jews at that time were causing problems all over the place. So Rome said, we've got to have a direct presence and we're just going to rule sovereignly. We're not working through a client king. Now, Galilee wasn't as tumultuous. It wasn't as problematic. And so Herod was allowed to continue ruling in the region of Galilee, but he still answered to Rome. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a little bit. Pontius Pilate was believed to have been born in central Italy, grew up in an environment of growing Roman stability and authority. He would have been born and raised in the time when Augustus was the Caesar. And of course, you remember about Augustus. He made the claim that when he came to Rome, he found it in bricks, and when he left it in marble. And the empire grew rapidly under Augustus. He brought an immense amount of stability. Jesus was born during the rule of Caesar Augustus. It was under him that you had really Rome connecting with roads. I mean, like the best in technology at the time, putting down stone roads so that they could trade and travel. You had the Pax Romana, Roman peace, that was enabling good commerce and trade so that you could travel from one city to the other without worrying about being mugged or jumped by the caravans. You had some more peace provided during the Roman era. And Pontius Pilate, growing up in central Italy, would have just been in that immediate environment. He was a Roman's Roman. He had control on Rome's behalf in all matters in Judea concerning the Roman military, the Roman treasury, and the Roman judiciary. The buck stopped with Pilate in Judea. Okay, so if it had to do with any of those three matters, he was at the top. If it was a military matter, Pilate could make the call. If it was a judicial matter, Pilate could make the call. So when we find in Mark chapter 15, and of course the other Gospels too, but when we find in Mark 15 that the Jews bring Jesus before Pilate, Pilate could have said, no, we're going to do this, and acted sovereignly. And the Jews would have had to just live with it. Now Pilate, as I talked about this morning, waffles with the political pressure, and the Jews are pressing and pressing, and so he yielded to their demands. The Bible specifically says that. And so to pacify the crowd, he hands Jesus over, and he releases Barabbas back into the population, and as the people are crying out for Jesus' blood, he allows that. But he could have said, as the sovereign Roman official in that district, he could have said, no, this is the way it's going to be. He had that power anyway. Because Judea didn't have a client king, Pilate was the judicial authority for the Jews, especially in matters of capital punishment. They didn't have a client king like Galilee did. It was just Pilate. And so they had to take all matters before him, which must have been very, very humbling, especially for the chief priests, because they were used to being in charge, right? And now they weren't. Rome was in charge. Okay, in this morning's study, we talked about Herod, so I want to talk about him for just a little bit. Herod at this time, Herod Antipas is the client king in Galilee. He is the son of Herod the Great. Anybody remember who that is? Herod the Great is the king at the time, yes, that Jesus is born. And you'll remember, as I was studying, I was getting all excited. I'm like, oh, yes, light bulbs are coming on. At the time that Jesus is born, remember, he is born in Bethlehem, and he spends a year or two in Bethlehem growing up there, and the wise men travel over from afar, because they were firemen, they came from afar, and they came, I know, it's old, beat that drum, pastor, beat that dead horse. They came over, And they come to Jerusalem looking for this king of the Jews, and they talk to Herod the Great. And he's in Jerusalem. He's not in Galilee. Because at that time, Augustus had approved Herod as the client king, not over the region, not only over the region of Judea, but of Galilee, that whole area there. Well, when Herod the Great dies, he leaves that kingdom to his three sons. You have Herod and Herod and Philip. And so to the one Herod, he leaves Galilee, Herod Antipas. To Herod Archelaus, he left the region of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. And to Philip II, the regions of Iturea and Trachonitis, or however you would pronounce it. Okay? So he breaks his kingdom up into three. Now, this is really interesting. These three, Herod dies, these three boys, by will of their dad, are to receive these three regions. But they haven't got the stamp of approval from Augustus, and because Rome is in charge, they have to in order to take sovereign claim of this. Well, there's this big insurrection that happens in Jerusalem, and Herod Archelaus, who had been given that region by his father, now has a pickle on his hands, and he's trying to take care of this because he hasn't had the opportunity to go before Augustus and receive his ratification to the seat. And things get out of hand, and it doesn't look so good. Well, as the story unfolds, they finally make their way over to Rome, and Augustus is able to hear their pleas. And as he's talking to, first of all, Herod Archelaus goes before the regional supervisor, director, whatever he was for Rome at that time, who says, "Yes, yes, I can see that you are heir of your father's kingdom down here," and he puts his stamp on it. But it's not official until Augustus puts his stamp on it. So he travels to Italy. And in Italy, then, Augustus looks at it and says, "You know, you haven't done real well here. But we'll honor your dad's wishes, and you can have that." Well, he's in place for about 2 years, and finally Augustus gets enough and pulls Herod Archelaus out of rulership and says, "Rome will take care of business in Judea." And he just combines Judea, Samaria, and Idumea into just one Roman region. Now, when you're looking at the New Testament Gospels especially, Jesus and the Jews still saw a separation because of the Samaritans, right? They were half-breeds and they were not liked. And so they saw a real difference. But Rome didn't see a difference. Pilate would have been over all of that. But Pilate didn't come into power until way later. As a matter of fact, well, before I get to the next screen here, one other comment on Herod Antipas. He was responsible for John the Baptist's death because John called him out on his incestuous marriage to his niece Herodias. And some of you might remember that from the scriptures, right? John the Baptist says, that is not right. And Herod says, "Well, I'm the king. Off with your head." And the end of John the Baptist. I don't mean to make light of that. He obviously is a tremendous servant of God, but that's Herod at the time who was in charge of that. So there's an interesting timeline here. I mentioned not long after Caesar Augustus confirmed the will of Herod the Great, he removed Herod Archelaus and made Judea, Samaria, and Idumea one Roman province, just called it Judea. Rome ruled the region directly. From 6 AD to 9 AD, a man by the name of Coponius was the prefect there in that area. From 9 AD to 13 AD, Marcus Ambivalus was the prefect. And then just a couple of years there, and I don't know what happened between 13 and 15. But then from 15 to 26, Valerius Gratus was the prefect. And if that name is familiar to you like it is to me, I kept thinking, where did I hear that name? Well, his name was mentioned in Ben-Hur. All of my references, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, Ben-Hur. I watch a lot of classic movies. In Ben-Hur, they mention Valerius Gratus, and he is being replaced in the play, in the movie, in the book, by Pontius Pilate, who comes to power in 26 AD. Now, if Jesus is crucified in 30 to 33 AD, somewhere in that neighborhood, I don't know for sure the crucifixion date. But if it's somewhere in that region, Pilate's already been in power for at least a few years. So he's got a good feel now for what's going on in Jerusalem and in the region. And he probably knows what he's dealing with politically here. It's not nice. It's not an easy assignment at all. And yet, nevertheless, he was the prefect for Rome. Jesus was believed to have died, like I say, 33 AD. also by this time, Rome understands what they're working with in the region of Judea. The Jews are not easy to govern. Okay, now to the scourging of Jesus. I didn't realize that I was going to take this long, but I was having so much fun. The scourging of Jesus. The Romans had three levels of beating. First was the fustigatio for minor infractions, and they used just like a single-stranded whip, like what we would probably think of as a bull whip or something like that, where they would scourge somebody for just petty crimes done on the street, for instance. Fegelosio, excuse me, was for more serious crimes. When you had something really serious done, then they would flog that person usually in public and inflict a lot more pain. But the worst of all was the verberatio, usually in connection with capital offenses. If you had somebody that committed murder, then they would be subjected to verberatio. It also often preceded crucifixion. I didn't understand that. I didn't know that. I thought that Jesus' crucifixion was probably very unique, but not necessarily the case. The Romans were pretty cruel. They understood that you could intensify the pain on the cross if you beat the person ahead of time. So commentators and scholars have well documented that by the time Jesus is nailed to the cross, we're talking about a roughly hewn beam or a post going up with a beam across. And as Jesus would move in order to draw breath on that cross, you can imagine that rough wood surface, what that would do to your back. Well, if you had no flesh back there and nerves are raw, you can imagine how that would intensify the whole crucifixion process. It's horrible. And the Romans quickly figured that out. So if you were a really, really bad person that they were going to crucify, they would scourge you ahead of time and expose those nerves. Verberatio was done traditionally with the flagrum, as it was known in Latin, also known by its slang term of the scorpion. And as I was studying this, I thought, it's just like people to have a slang term that they would use for their weapons. I shared this morning that I have a number of veteran friends. And you know what? They name their guns. They name their helicopters and fighter jets. All these things have names, right, that they refer to. Well, the Roman soldiers referred to that cat of nine tails, which is what we traditionally refer to it as the scorpion. It was the whip that they used to beat people with in the verberatio. It's a little bit different. Probably all of you have heard that whip referred to as the cat of nine tails your whole life. I know I have. But the cat of nine tails is actually a term that we have gotten. It traces back originally to the Egyptians. They were the first to develop this whip. And for the Egyptians, of course, the cat was a sacred animal, right? They worshiped the cat. It was a symbol of deity. And so they made this whip out of cat hide, and they would tie the knots at the end. And their view was that as they were whipping the criminal, that some manner of righteousness was being imparted to the criminal by the beating with this cat whip. So it goes all the way back to ancient Egypt. Way later on, if you skip way ahead in time, the British Navy then decided to use that same concept and to maintain order on their naval ships. They also had this whip. So if you stepped out of line on a Navy ship and you were, and you were to be beaten, they would bring out this cat of nine tails. Now, it was called the cat of nine tails because, of course, in connection with the nine lives of the cat, or the believed nine lives of the cat, they had nine tails. And just like the Egyptian whip, the British used knots at the end. The Romans' whip was a little bit different. It didn't have knots at the end. It is very clearly known to have had, they would tie sharp bits of metal, pieces of pottery, stones, all kinds of just nasty little jagged instruments. And that was why they called it the scorpion, because of the sting that came with each slash with this terrible tool. One other thing that I thought was of interest, the Jews, they scourged, and that was a part of their practice, even commonly, in taking care of judicial matters. And there were other ancient civilizations that beat people publicly as a means of punishment for different crimes. The Jews had a limit of 40, okay? And so, as you've probably heard it taught and preached before, a lot of times there was somebody standing right there counting, because the guy that was whipping, if he went over 40, he then would be whipped. And so he did not want to go over 40, and a lot of times they would stop at 39 just to make sure. But somebody would be counting. Somebody would be keeping track of that. The Romans didn't have a magic number. And if you were with me this morning as we were looking at the text there in Mark, the Roman soldiers are the ones responsible for beating Jesus. And as I was thinking about this, I thought, okay, the Jews are calling, they're demanding Jesus' crucifixion, for one thing. You already know that the crowd is worked up and they are filled with hate and they're demanding Jesus' death. Do they really care how many times the Romans strike Jesus? Possibly not. Possibly, but possibly not. They probably handed him over. This is Rome's concern. And Pilate then says he is to be scourged. And the Roman soldiers take him out. The Roman soldiers were not obligated by Jewish law, and they could have continued beating him. I watched a video this week, just a simple animation, to demonstrate the destructiveness of just 40 lashings with this scorpion, right, this whip that the Romans used. And it was just unbelievable. After 20, really, the whole back is red. But if he just continues to be beaten over and over and over again, I don't know how many of you, and I don't mean to be gruesome or gory tonight by any means, but I think that it helps us to appreciate what our Savior went through. By the time 40 lashings were done, if it was just 40, and I'm just going to use that number assuming that maybe it was right in that neighborhood, by the time he is done with 40 of those, there's probably not any muscle or skin, certainly, left on his back. And many who have studied that say that it's very possible that his entrails are beginning to fall out. There's nothing holding him together, literally. So giving him back his robe is very essential to keeping Jesus put together. Now, he couldn't have lost too much of his muscle mass, because he still has to move from Jerusalem up to the place of crucifixion. But he's lost enough, certainly, to where he cannot carry the cross. Somebody has to be called upon to help. I mean, the amount of blood that is lost, I don't know how many of you saw the interview with Mel Gibson after the making of The Passion of the Christ, but Mel Gibson said at one point in that they had to stop short. They knew that it was way worse than what they could show on the movie, and he said, and they wanted to take it to that extent. But the horrors of that, they knew they would lose a lot of their audience members, so they had to put a limit on how gruesome that scene got. But it would have been horrible, okay? And the Romans practiced this pretty routinely. I mean, Jesus isn't the only person in history that was crucified, right? The Romans did this all the time, and they had it down to a science. As a matter of fact, you probably are aware of this, but excruciating is the term that they came up with to describe the pain that one felt. And it's from the Latin compound word, out of the cross. And so, you know, when somebody says the pain was excruciating, it goes back to the word that was developed by the Romans to explain the pain that one felt on the cross. It was more than they had a word for. And and so it was horrible, horrible, horrible. And then, of course, you have the crucifixion. All right, I've gone way, way long, and I went into some details there I don't know were necessary, but did anyway. Questions, comments? Did you have, Sonny?
Yeah, I got
yeah, go ahead.
I actually appreciate you going into the detail and bringing up the movie passion.